Okay, this is the time set for argument in One West Bank FSB versus Home International Properties, case 72933. And again, we have a bit of an unusual division of argument. We have 20 minutes per side, with 5 going to amicus, I believe, on the appellant's side on this case. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. One thing, though, because the issues raised by FHFA directly apply to Fannie Mae and are so important to our argument, we would, with the court's permission, give 2 of our minutes to FHFA.
Okay, so 13 to you.
15, I'll have 13.
Very well. That's fine. And that doesn't alter the allocation to the other side.
I plan to use these poster boards and for the convenience of the court, since I'm kind of being away at Justice Gibbons.
Yeah, please approach, and that would be fine.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
Ms. Chu.
Yes.
And you have copies for opposing counsel?
Yes. Okay.
You know, Judge.
Do you have any problems with this? Okay, we'll take a moment and look at it. And you may reserve some of your time for rebuttal as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, honorable justices. Summary judgment in favor of Home should be reversed, and the district court should be directed to enter summary judgment in favor of Fannie Mae and One West Bank. For 2 reasons. First, the HOA sale was void because it was conducted under Chapter 116 and not 117, and which did not provide for a super priority lien, but instead permitted a mortgage protection clause. And second, because the federal foreclosure bar under HERA precluded extinguishment of Fannie Mae's deed of trust. Either reason is sufficient for reversal with directions. If the sale was void, then no interest was conveyed to Home, and Fannie Mae should have prevailed on its quiet title claim and should have defeated Home's counterclaim for quiet title. If instead the sale went forward on a subordinate interest, as provided in Chapter 117 and the CC&Rs, then Home took subject to Fannie Mae's deed of trust, and once again, Fannie Mae should have prevailed. If instead the sale went forward under Chapter 116, then the federal foreclosure bar would have precluded extinguishment of the deed of Fannie Mae's deed of trust. There's a third ground, which I noted in the synopsis, and that's commercial reasonableness, but that one is not as cut and dried. That defense is intertwined with the Chapter 117-116 issue. Given the inadequate purchase price compared to the market value,
what was that disparity?
$44,000 was the purchase price, and the market value was $80,000.
So, Mr. Nitz, on commercial reasonableness, putting aside the other arguments for now, do you feel there's a genuine issue of material fact as to commercial reasonableness based on Shadowwood and any other cases we have?
I would put it, frame it more as a material issue of an issue of material law rather than fact. Fraud, oppression, and unfairness exist by the fact that the CC&Rs maintain the development is a 117 condominium project without super priority, and the recorded statutorily defective amendment in 2000 was wholly insufficient to provide record notice to any mortgage owner or holder that the provisions of Chapter 7, 117 were no longer applicable. The foreclosure notices stated the sale was being conducted under Chapter 116, where super priority HOA liens are recognized, and the district court erroneously concluded it was. The Las Verdes Community Association was a condominium development formed before NRS Chapter 116 went into effect, and it was formed under Chapter 117, according to the CC&Rs. The subsequent amendments to Chapter 116 did not change that fact and did not convert the Chapter 117 Condominium Association into a Chapter 116 Common Interest Community Association. When Chapter 116 was amended in 1999, effective 2000, it did not repeal Chapter 117. It's important to note that Chapter 117 is called condominiums, and that's what these are. Instead, the legislature left intact the provisions under NRS 117 that provided the mechanism for an HOA to convert to a Chapter 116 association. But Las Verdes did not follow that procedure here. By a plain reading of NRS 117.070, the HOA had a junior lien. If a junior lien forecloses, the purchaser at the foreclosure sale takes the property subject to the senior lien, which in this case was the deed of trust. Chapter 117 of the CC&Rs also provided that the association's lien could be and was subordinate to the first deed of trust, something not permitted under Chapter 116 since the SFR decision's interpretation of 116.1104. 117.070 sub 2 expressly permits subordination, and that's what these CC&Rs did, consistent with the statute. And Chapter 117 further provided that the association's lien shall expire and be of no further force or effect 1 year from the date of recordation of the notice of assessment. The sale took place 8 months after that year expired. The condominium project remained a condominium association subject to Chapter 117, despite the amendments to Chapter 116. In this case, the association was created under Chapter 117. The original CC&R state whereas it is the desire and intention of the grantor to sell the subject property and to create a certain type or method of ownership commonly known as condominium, and to submit the subject property to the provisions of Chapter 117 of NRS. The subsequent amendments to the CC&Rs in March, May, December 91, and December 96 had essentially the same paragraph. Now, the CC&Rs Section 7 specifically defined condominiums. Condominium shall mean and refer to the real estate, to an estate and real property as defined in 117.010 sub 2A, and shall consist of a living unit coupled with a separate interest in the boundaries of which are described in the condominium plan. NRS 116.027 defines condominium in for that chapter, and it specifically limits application. It says a common interest community is not a condominium unless the undivided interests in the common elements are vested in the unit's owners. This section 7 vests the living unit coupled with the separate interests within the boundaries described in the condominium plan. So that qualifies as condominium under the limitation or condition of 116.027.
Mr. Nitz, can I ask you, as you know, our orders are citable now, and I'm just wondering if you're familiar with a case called J.P. Morgan Bank versus 1209 Village Walk Trust, LLC. It was decided by this court on March 20, 2018.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay, how does that play into your argument then?
In fact, we cited that in a supplemental notice of authorities. Mm-hmm. Quite simply, Village Walk, if I shorten it that way, does not apply. That case is a fact-specific, or more particularly, a CC&R-specific case. Village Walk was decided by looking at the express wording of the CC&Rs, which are different than the subject CC&Rs. One principle recognized by Village Walk, I think, does apply here, and that's retroactive application of statutes is generally disfavored because a fundamental principle of jurisprudence holds that a retroactive application of new laws is usually unfair. In Village Walk, the CC&R specifically provided for subsequent legislative amendments. They stated that the assessment lien may be enforced by sale pursuant to NRS 117.075 as from time to time amended or any successor statute. Thus, after the 1999 Chapter 116 amendments, the property's CC&Rs were deemed to conform to Chapter 116, the successor statute. And those included the imposition of the super priority liens. However, in the subject property, CC&Rs did not. The CC&Rs provided in Section 8, a lien created pursuant to this section may be enforced in any manner permitted by law, including as permitted by NRS 117.075, as now or hereafter in effect. What's missing is that language about or any successor statute. So you can't compare Village Walk CC&Rs to the Las Verdes CC&Rs by that one distinct difference. Even the amended CC&Rs did not alter that section, and while they did amend Article 3, Section 9 regarding foreclosure, that did not change how foreclosures may occur or under what statute. In fact, the amended CC&R Section 9 continued to echo NRS 117.075, subparagraphs 1 through 3. The Home would argue that these CC&Rs were automatically amended, and the HOA, the association, automatically became Chapter 116 HOA by the 1990 amendments to the statute. However, in 1999, the legislature did not repeal Chapter 117. It left Chapter 117 totally in effect, and specifically, it left NRS 117.020, which provides the mechanism by which homeowners may amend or revoke the condominium project plan. And that statute says, until recordation of a revocation, the provisions of this chapter continue to apply to the property. Here, the HOAs never complied with the statutory mechanism for revoking the applicability of Chapter 117 and with Chapter 116. While they recorded this thing called the first statutorily mandated amendment, This does not comply with the requirements of 117.020. First, the amended CC&Rs were executed by the HOA only, and the statute expressly required that they be signed by the HOA, all record owners, and all record holders of security interest therein. And this was solely the HOA. So by that point alone, the attempted amendment or revocation was ineffective. I would also point out that that first amendment, first amended, did not ever state that it was revoking the application of Chapter 117. Second, the HOA is, as I discussed earlier, is a condominium development, not a common interest community.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Johnson, on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Federal Housing Finance Agency. Again, my gratitude to the panel and the Court for allowing me and my client to present its views. I will address the federal foreclosure bar only. The District Court erred and should be reversed in denying Fannie Mae's motion for summary judgment on the basis that Fannie Mae did not have a recorded interest in the deed of trust at the time of the HOA foreclosure sale. That is at the District Court's order, page 7. Under Monteith, Fannie Mae had a recorded and perfected interest in the deed of trust because the record beneficiary of the deed of trust was One West, Fannie Mae's authorized, contractually authorized representative. And under Monteith, that is sufficient to establish not just an executed deed of trust, but a perfected deed of trust.
Mr. Johnson, I reflected more on your previous argument from this morning. I'm concerned about this recording issue. I understand your other arguments there, but the more I thought about it, the more it bothers me, you know, when the stuff goes unrecorded. So tell me again what your argument is under the federal foreclosure bar, what impact recording has, if anything. If you can just give me a quick synopsis of your position on that.
Very simple, Your Honor. Property interests are defined by state law. We agree that there must be, I would call it an interest, not a right, and I would call it application of the statute rather than a remedy, but I think we're in the same place. We need to show that there was a property interest. Mm-hmm. And when we look at Monteith, we have the same situation. Owner of the note and owner of the deed of trust is not the same entity whose name appears in the recorded instruments as the beneficiary. Mm-hmm. And the en banc court said, in Nevada, perfection of a deed of trust occurs upon proper execution and recordation, and that in that case, Deutsche Bank, the owner, but not the named beneficiary, mm-hmm. and I'm quoting here, it's talking about Deutsche Bank security interest, because the security interest attached and was perfected before the bankruptcy. So at the time MERS, Deutsche Bank's contractually authorized representative appeared as the deed of trust's beneficiary, Deutsche Bank had an attached and perfected security interest. Now, perfected, what does that add? That adds rights against third parties. That's what made Deutsche Bank a secured creditor who was able to jump ahead in the bankruptcy of all the unsecured creditors. If Deutsche Bank only had rights against the borrower, but it had not perfected its interest by recording that deed of trust, it would have had to get in line with everyone else. It didn't. And that was what was before the court in Monteith. What happened in Monteith is that the debtor, filed a two-page objection to Deutsche Bank's claim. The entire substance of its objection to Deutsche Bank's claim was Deutsche Bank, they call it Bank of New York, that's either an error or because they transposed the deed of trust beneficiary. The entire substance is Deutsche Bank is an unsecured creditor because the names on the note and the deed of trust don't match up. And the court en banc said no. Deutsche Bank has a perfected security interest in the property. Montier, and this panel in the Guberlin case endorsed that analysis of Montier. Now, of course, Guberlin is unreported. We're not citing it as precedent. But the panel would have to change its mind about Montier to come out the other way. The panel has considered it. It's, of course, free to reconsider if it likes. But we're not coming out of left field with some crazy interpretation of Montier. This is the interpretation of Montier that the panel adopted in Guberlin. So what do we hear from the other side? We hear, well, Montier might be wrong. It's somehow inconsistent with Leyva and Edelstein. We talked about that this morning, but I'll say it again. What we have is a taxonomy where there's the easy case and the Edelstein case, where the owner of the note and the beneficiary of the deed of trust are the same entity. It matches up, no problem, whether they were different entities at some point earlier. If at the relevant time they're the same, that entity has a property interest and is able to foreclose. Where the owner of the note and the beneficiary of the deed of trust are not the same entity, we look at first Leyva. And what Leyva says is, if there is not a proper assignment, then no ability to foreclose, and that's interpreted to mean no property interest. We talked a little bit how I think that's a little more extreme. I think there does remain a contingent or limited or partial interest that would be protected by the federal foreclosure bar, but no ability to foreclose where there's not a proper assignment. And the assignment, the documents in that case were not deemed proper because there was a lack of connection. No relationship of contractual authorization between the note owner and the deed of trust.
Yes, but the problem, the nub of the problem for me, and I understand what you're saying about Leyva and Montier and Edelstein, but by virtue of it being a Fannie Mae entity that has the interest, it alters the ability of those with a senior interest to the Fannie Mae interest, an ostensibly senior interest, to foreclose and give title free of that interest. There's this consent mechanism that gets going, and if there's no consent, then there's no foreclosure under the Berezovsky reading of the federal foreclosure bar statute. And I understand everyone's focusing on property because the foreclosure bar statute talks about property. But it's worrisome to me that you have no notice of record of this assignment that alters the consequences to somebody with a senior interest. It chips away at that, and it chips away at a buyer's from that person on a foreclosure sale of the ostensibly senior interest, yet there's no notice. So that's the problem I have with it.
And
you may have a minute.
Thank you, Justice Pickering. I appreciate that. I would point the court to a case we cited in our brief. It's a United States Supreme Court decision. It's all about the fairness of interests that a legislature puts ahead of everyone else and that cannot be discovered from an examination of the record.
It's the New York car case.
The New York trucks case. The New York trucks case. It is absolutely dispositive of the fairness and due process issues here. In that case, a truck dealer sold vehicles on credit to someone who used them in the state of New York. New York imposes a road tax that the trucking company, not the truck seller, is required to pay.
Right, but they're analyzing that on a due process, and I guess I just keep circling back to 106, 210, 220. Are they trying to require some notice be recorded in Nevada? Is that what Nevada is saying? And if so, does the federal preemption bar
No, Your Honor. What the foreclosure bar requires is a property interest that would be recognized under state law. And under Montier, this interest would be recognized. If there is an issue with Congress giving somebody extra rights, just like the New York legislature in the International Harvester, the trucking case, gave the taxing authority extra rights to jump ahead of the poor truck dealer who had repossessed the trucks. I mean, he thought, hey, these are mine. I get to resell them. And in swoops the taxing authority and says, no, 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 there's a huge lien for back taxes on these. And the poor dealer says, lien? What lien? I recorded my UCC-1. I looked. Where is it? And the United States Supreme Court said the lien wasn't recorded. It couldn't be disclosed. It was a criminal violation to disclose the lien, so there is no way the truck dealer could have found out about it. And the United States Supreme Court says that is the legislature's prerogative to put that primary on. And so the redress here would be in Congress. If there is a problem with Congress putting the conservator's property ahead of everyone else, the redress is in Congress. I appreciate the court's time and attention. Thank you.
Could you please add an additional 2 minutes to Council's time? Council, who's rising now?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Justice Gibbons, Justice Pickering, Justice Hardesty. May it please the Court, my name is Darius Raffi, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today. At the respondents' table is my associate, Rick Walsh, and Sean Anderson for the HOA. I want to start first with the first issue that was listed. The issue that we were to address in the order that we were to address them. Whether Fannie Mae had a valid interest in the property and needed to record that interest. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this case. It's an interesting distinction, the case he just raised. In this case, there is no criminal violation to disclose Fannie's interest in this property. The other thing that I attended earlier and I wanted to address, too, before I get into my arguments, is that Monteith is the context where you're talking about the property interests as they relate to, and I will use the borrower term, because originally it was a borrower, and then it was a debtor in bankruptcy. And Monteith doesn't have a problem, I would suggest, because in application to our case, because here we're talking about the rights of third parties. You can't perfect an interest in property without first having an attachment. And this court has already recognized in Monteith, it was wise enough to say, you know, we are talking about the rights as they pertain to a borrower or a debtor in that case. But
the attachment. But it also applies to other creditors of that debtor. I mean, it moves the guy ahead. The statement was they've got top pole position. They do. When bankruptcy freezes it at the moment of the filing and it says at this point you're secured.
But the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is this.
Because your interest was perfected, so.
Right, but that's not to third parties. That is to the debtor. To the debtor in that case. That's the specific distinction of Monteith. And the Monteith Court actually said that. It said, we recognize that attachment only occurs as to a borrower or the mortgagor when there's an execution. This goes to the point that was raised earlier about the concern of the court about notice. When a party sits across a table and they execute a mortgage, they know that mortgage, and therefore there's an attachment to that property. And the court was wise enough to say, but it's upon recordation as to third parties. And so I want to raise another issue that was raised earlier. We want to also incorporate a reference to NRS 111.315, 111.320, and 111.325. These are the statutes that relate to recording interests as they relate to third parties. Now, the 2 points I need to make to this court today. You should not allow Fannie to assert a real property interest in Nevada without complying with Nevada law. Now, they've already admitted that. Because earlier they're trying to, anytime we have any kind of HERA issue, then there's preemption. Well, No, you have to establish the property right first, so I'm glad that we've gotten there. To allow Fannie to record in the name of a contract servicer, though, defeats the entire purpose of a recording statute as to third parties. Inextricably intertwined with a state recording statute is the notice that it provides to the world. Without a requirement that Fannie record in its own name, that notice becomes impossible or unworkable, and as this court has said in Edelstein, quote, encourages a lack of transparency. And that's what you need against third parties. You need notice and transparency because they didn't sit at the table. They aren't the mortgagor. They didn't sit across the table from the bank and execute the documents. You need notice and transparency. And if you allow them to do this, you are operating in what we've all acknowledged as Nevada law, transparency as to the world, and you're dropping a giant curtain in that system, and you're throwing that system on its ear. Now, this is an important point I need to also make for this case, the facts of this case. Even if you allow a contract servicer of Fannie to establish Fannie's property interest under HERA and the federal foreclosure bar by recording a beneficial interest in the deed of trust in its own name, the facts in this case dictate a result in the favor of the respondent. Why? Because the contracted servicer for Fannie at the time of this HOA sale was not the recorded beneficiary of the deed of trust. The contracted servicer, by their own admission, was Ocwen. The recorded beneficiary of the deed of trust at the time of the HOA sale was One West. Let me go back to issue number one. Complying with Nevada law is what U.S. Congress intended when it passed and implemented HERA. We know it did not expressly preempt state law with respect to dividing a property interest. Property interest is not a defined term in HERA, and Congress did not create a separate federal database for recording property interests. Thus, the only rational conclusion is that Congress intended property interest to be defined as it has been for 100 years, and now they've admitted it. In fact, in Berezovsky, the court cited Erie for the rule, said, quote, except matters governed by the federal constitution or by acts of Congress, the law to be applied in any case is the law of the state. The problem with the Berezovsky ruling is what I've explained already with the distinction of Montier from this case. Berezovsky looked at the case's case law and said, oh, well, if in Montier there was a property interest against a mortgagor or a borrower, then there's a property interest. Well, that's not what we're dealing with here today. We're dealing with a property interest against the world or against third parties that complies with NRS 111. That's what we're dealing with. So there is no conflict with Montier, so to speak. There is no conflict. I suggest to the court that Berezovsky had improper analysis. What Berezovsky failed to do is recognize the language that Montier stated for them. As to third parties, if you want a secured interest in property, you must record. To get an attachment, you can't have a perfection unless you're first attached. The Montier court recognized the difference and Berezovsky failed to apply it. And you, Your Honors, can fix that problem. In Nevada, we've been using a grantor-grantee index, by my understanding, prior to becoming a state. So for 130 years. If you choose to rule otherwise and allow entities and people to establish a real property interest by simply showing up to court with printouts from their computers, or as in the past, dusty documents from the castle vault, or even worse yet, behind closed doors with the intent to confuse and confound. These documents are created behind closed doors with the intent to confuse and confound. You will turn real property law in the state of Nevada on its ear. And you will be dealing with a magnitude of unforeseen issues as a result. And the first issue I listed here, and yes, I did collaborate with the SFR attorneys, okay? But we came to the same conclusion ourselves. You're going to affect these situations where a conventional first is foreclosed upon, and a second held by Fannie behind the curtain is going to be affected. And all of a sudden, you've created all kinds of havoc. How do lawyers give opinions on title? How do title companies give title insurance in that system? How do judges decide what title is in that system? And they say, well, you can simply come to Fannie and ask. Or you had the proactive duty to come to Fannie and ask. That seems to be very self-serving to me, when they're the ones that are receiving notices for months and months and months, purportedly to their alleged contract servicers, and they fail to record in their name to protect their interests. If anything, they have the opportunity to protect their interests. I love the question, how are we supposed to inquire about something we don't even know about? That exactly hits the point on the head. There is no proactive duty for a purchaser to inquire, even if they did inquire at the foreclosure sale. Does anybody really believe they're going to get an answer from Fannie in the time that they need at a foreclosure sale? That is not what Congress intended when it passed TARA. That is what Fannie is arguing you should do here today by ignoring one requirement for preemption, that is, to establish a property right first. But I want to move on. Before I do that, though, I submit that there's some helpful language in Edelstein. That court said, it is prudent to have the recorded beneficiary be the actual beneficiary, and not just a shell for the true beneficiary. In Nevada, the purpose of recording a beneficial interest under a deed of trust is to provide constructive notice to all persons, to permit an entity that is not really the beneficiary to record itself as the beneficiary would defeat the purposes of the recording statute and encourage a lack of transparency. Now, my second point. Even if you choose to do this to allow Fannie to establish a property interest by having that deed recorded in a contracted servicer's name, in this case, you should affirm on that issue. And here's why. I won't go through the fact that Fannie Mae was not the recorded beneficiary, because we all know that here. In order to even get into discussion of 4617J3, you have to get the property interest. They've agreed with that. So in this case, they cannot claim or establish that they had a contracted servicer as a record beneficiary of the deed of trust, because by their own admission, they say otherwise. First, I want to point out one of the problems in the timeline of this case. March 2013, MERS assigns a beneficial interest to One West. Then all of the notices occur in this case for Chapter 116. The foreclosure sale occurs on December 12th, 2014, and the trustee's deed is recorded the next day, December 15th, 2014. Then, approximately two months later, on February 11th, MERS assigns a beneficial interest to Ocwen as the servicer for Fannie Mae. Now, ask yourselves, how does that happen? That's a broken chain. You're not even in the chain of title. How does MERS assign its interest in 2013 to One West, and then all of a sudden, in 2015, MERS is assigning it to Ocwen? Doesn't there have to be an assignment back from One West to MERS? That's the first problem. Second problem is even worse. Fannie, in its own motion for summary judgment, page 6, paragraph number 5, it's WFZ00861 in the record, admitted the following, quote, at the time of the HOA sale, on December 12, 2014, Ocwen was the servicer of the loan for Fannie. A Additionally, they referred to Exhibit B of that motion, which is the declaration of John Sturgill. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. Who, by his own words in that declaration, says he's the assistant vice president for FANG, who has personal knowledge and of and competency to testify as to matters stated herein. Paragraph 9 of his declaration, in the record WFZ00794-795, states, quote, the final three pages of Exhibit A are SIR servicing transfer detail printouts reflecting that the rights to service this loan for Fannie Mae were transferred to CIT Bank, National Association. They're going to say that CIT was what One West later became, so that's not the problem. But the operative language here is from CIT to Ocwen Loan Servicing on or about August 31st, 2013. 2013, we're talking about approximately 15 months before the HOA sale happened in this case. So they're saying in their motion for summary judgment that Ocwen was our servicer before and through the HOA sale. They're pointing to the declaration to prove that fact. But the problem is this. What do the county recorder's records say? They say One West is the record beneficiary of the deed.
Was Ocwen representing One West at this stage? Or I'm trying to calculate this in my mind how it works.
Ocwen's
a servicer, isn't it? Or are they a bank too, you know?
The point is this, though. When they provide the information in their motion for summary judgment at the district court level, they say, our servicer at the time of the HOA sale was Ocwen. They don't say Ocwen was somehow related to One West. They don't build any nexus. They don't testify to that at all.
There can be a servicer acting on behalf of the beneficiary. That's what I'm trying to figure that out. You're just saying this is what the documents say. This is what
right. I mean, it's hard to figure out, and that's the point, is it gets back to the notice problem, right? Everybody has to guess. But the bottom line is, when they had a chance to bring this issue to the court, to the district court, their testimony is that Ocwen is their servicer. And we know the other undisputed facts are One West is the deed of trust beneficiary recorded through the county recorder. Now, I don't know if there's some explanation, as Justice Gibbons has pointed out, I don't know. I have to assume it was an error on their part and not purposeful. Page three of their brief to this court misstates those facts that they stated to the district court. They say in that One West was the contractually authorized servicer and record beneficiary at the time of the HOA sale. They don't say Ocwen. They don't say, as they did to the district court. They don't say One West and its relationship, and this is the relationship with Ocwen. They say to this court that One West was their contracted servicer. Direct contradiction to their testimony when we had the motion for summary judgment hearing. So by their own admission, their contracted servicer at the time of this HOA sale was not the recorded deed beneficiary. Now, before I move on to the final issues, was that a B?
You have 5 minutes.
Sorry, 5 minutes?
Yes.
Before I move on to the final issues, I just want to suggest that this is a perfect example why you should not allow Fannie Mae to convince you to allow them to have a property without requiring them to record their interests in their name. There is simply too much room for error when a bank and a GSE are willing to say anything at any time to gain a legal upper hand. Now, I want to move on to the 116-117 arguments. One West has produced no evidence at all that they were confused about which NRS chapter applies at the time of the HOA foreclosure sale. Between April 8, 2013 and December 2014, the HOA mailed and recorded all the required notices leading up to the actual foreclosure sale. At no time did One West respond to the HOA notices to express confusion about whether 116 or 117 applied. This is just another example of the appellant creating an argument without supporting facts to support its position.
I guess the question in my mind, after listening to Mr. Nitz argue this, is when 116 went on the books after 117 already existed, was this conversion of 117 to 116 by operation of law where the association doesn't have to do anything, or does an association have to do what Mr. Nitz suggested, do a formal conversion from 117 to 116? I don't think we've had that issue here before, so I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
So how I would answer that is this, I think it's the exact question that needs to be answered. So I would say this. This case is very similar to J.P. Morgan, even though they try to distinguish it, right? The 1999 amendments to Chapter 17 include the language, quote, any declaration, bylaw, or other governing document of a common interest community created before January 1st, 1992 that does not conform to the provisions of this chapter, and this is the good part, shall be deemed to conform with those provisions by operation of law. And any such declaration, bylaw, or other governing document is not required to be amended to conform to those provisions. Furthermore, the amendment removed the date limitation regarding applicability. NRS 116.1203.1 says the applicability state, it says, this chapter applies to all common interest communities created within this state. Common interest community is defined as real estate with respect to which a person is obligated to pay for real estate other than that unit. The legal description, document WFZ-01100 is part of this record, states the legal description for this property as an undivided 0.025 fractional interest as tenants in common in and to the real property described in the condominium plan. So, it was by operation of law, Justice Havens. It didn't have to happen, but I want to add this. In 2000, the HOA attempts to make the amendments. Then in 2007, the mortgage comes along. Well, they have all that time. They've had 7 years to look before they take a mortgage. They look, hey, in 2000, the HOA tried to make these amendments. Whether they're defective or not, doesn't matter, because at least you knew what they were trying to do. You also knew the law changed in 1999, that there was no requirement. It was by operation of law. Okay? And they do nothing. They take a mortgage out under that scenario. And that's my point.
But the puzzling thing is, why does 117 persist and continue to exist if we credit your argument? And I get that Village Walk appears to credit that argument, but it is puzzling that...
I agree with Your Honor. It is puzzling. Not everything's perfect in the legislative world. We all understand that. It is puzzling. But here's the bottom line. In 1999, by operation of law, and by definition that this HOA and these CC&Rs adopted, okay, that there were fractional interests. There are not undivided condominium interests. There are not divisional condominium interests. There is a portion of this complex that is undivided fractional interests shared. Language says tenants in common. It just can't get any stronger than that. And then the point then being, they take a mortgage out in this scenario and never once bring this to anybody's attention, never once question it, get notices of a foreclosure sale, and never once say, hey, this lien can't be good anymore because it's a 117 lien. This was not, it didn't create any confusion on the part of the bank. Okay, so this is just an argument that's been made up after the fact. After the case is filed, okay, now all of a sudden, this is a creative legal argument, and I understand it. It addresses something that causes some issues. I understand. But at the end of the day, they argue that that somehow impacted the value that was given, the commercial reasonableness of this property. And I think that it's almost stated strongly when you say that the respondent in this case paid $44,000 for an estimated property value of $80,000. And let's understand this, too.
You're out of time, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I would just conclude just by saying then that, therefore, this court should affirm it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice Pickering.
Justice Hardesty has a question of you, so don't leave.
I just have a request that you provide the record site to the deed to the property in this case to the clerk at the when arguments are over.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you again. Have you yielded the balance of your time to Amicus?
I didn't.
How much time is left? 14 seconds? No.
We have more than that.
There's 17 seconds left?
17 seconds over.
Okay.
I thought I had reserved 2 minutes. I did answer some questions. I could use the 2 minutes productively, but if I don't want to impose on the court either.
Let's hear from both. I like you.
You want to hear?
I want to hear from both.
Okay. Justice Gibbons has called it, and he would like to give a minute each or 2 minutes each?
Two each. I'm sorry. It's up to you.
Okay. That's fine.
Thank you. I just want to address two things. I want to get back to the property interest issue and then touch on this Ocwen versus One West issue, which is really just smoke and mirrors. On property interest, I want to pose a question to the court that I think will be very illuminating. Let's assume there wasn't a federal foreclosure bar. Let's assume that statute was not on the books. Would we think that Fannie Mae had a property interest under Nevada law? I think the answer is heck yes. Heck yes, we would. Because this court has always looked to the restatement, and the restatement is perfectly clear on the point that secondary market investors own the note and the deed of trust when the deed of trust is recorded in the name of their contractually authorized representative. The thing that makes it confusing here is that we do have the federal foreclosure bar, and Congress granted some owners of deeds of trust extra priority. Now, Nevada's recording statutes are set up to function very well, and their function is to disclose the existence and timing of liens, because under state law, the timing is what governs priority. When Congress stepped in and gave some owners of liens extra priority, that's why the conservator gets protected. And so we are talking about federal law controlling here. And we do need to direct people who don't like the way Nevada's laws work, given the way Congress altered the priority of certain liens, we need to direct them back to Congress, not to this court. Regarding One West and Ocwen, it's true that Ocwen was a servicer, but One West was still in a contractual relationship with Fannie Mae as a former servicer, and Fannie Mae's servicing guide, the current guide, A2-7-03 and F1-1-11, and the old guide, Part 1, Section 205.03, require former servicers to do whatever is necessary to protect Fannie Mae's lien. So that Montague.
Mr. Johnson, who is the beneficiary? They're both servicers.
One West.
One West is a beneficiary slash servicer.
No, One West, at the time of the HOA sale, One West was still the record beneficiary of the deed of trust,
okay,
but servicing had transferred to Ocwen. So One West was a former servicer, still bound by the guide to protect Fannie Mae's interests, so still in that Montier relationship.
Thank you.
I thank the court for its indulgence.
Thank you, Your Honors, for the additional time. I want to address the question of the 117 versus 116 issue. As I indicated before, Chapter 117 was not repealed by the 1999 legislature when it amended 116. And this is the distinction, every common interest community is governed by 116. I think that part's clear. But not every condominium is a common interest community. That's the point of that citation to 116.027. Just like every human is a mammal, but not every mammal is a human. Therefore, not every condominium association is governed by Chapter 116. If it were, then, Justice Pickering, your question would be absolutely appropriate. Why would the legislature leave on the books for now almost 20 years Chapter 117 if every condominium association was automatically converted to Chapter 116 association?
But if it's a residential one, isn't it, or not? What residential condos are not subject to 116 definitionally?
You have to look at the definition of condominiums, which by 116.027, it showed if you have an interest in the living unit and you have an interest in everything else, then you're a condominium, and then it's not a common interest community. The actual language of the 1999 amendment is really important here. This is 309. Notwithstanding any other law of the provision, any declaration of bylaw of a common interest community, which this is not, created on or after January 1992, which this wasn't, that does not conform, must be changed to conform to those provisions, and may be so changed without complying with procedure requirements. You have two conditions. One, that it's a common interest community. Two, that it was before January 1, 1992. You never even reach, must be changed, or may be so changed. This amendment doesn't even apply by that language. We would ask that the judgment be reversed.
Okay, well, this matter was